Tell me about the Jobs Act. What has been the impact of the Jobs Act?
The impact of the Jobs Act is bigger than I think most people understand. It tripled the number of life sciences IPOs. It actually led to the financing of Moderna, which and their messenger RNA technology. This is not me saying it, but their chief financial officer, Lawrence Kim, and that, you know, led to that, saved 2 million lives right there. But there were another 18 drugs that the Biotechnology Innovation Organization credits with having, you know, been passed through the FDA in the first 5 years because of this trebling of the number of life sciences IPOs, and then created an entire ecosystem of crowdfunding, generally solicited private placement kinds of portals, 506C, and kind of liberated poor people from not being able to solicit money from people that had money. Most poor people don't know people with money, right? So, and they couldn't raise small amounts of money from the people that they did know, because that, until the Jobs Act was blocked. So I think it, you know, put me on a, you know, an incredible tour of speaking for everything from the Rainbow Push Coalition to the Obama White House, at the I Have a Dream Summit, to the National Black Chamber of Commerce, and gave a lot of people a lot of hope that they could raise small amounts of money to start businesses. So it's really pretty remarkable.
So what was your role in passing this, or in creating the environment that it was passed?
Well, I wrote a series of papers, and I was the lead author, and pointing out that, for instance, markets, one of the titles, Market Structure is Causing the IPO Crisis and More. And we created a series of economic arguments that showed that we probably lost upwards of 10 million jobs, quality jobs, from the U.S. economy because we dropped the bottom out of the small initial public offering market, among other things. And We were the first to demonstrate that there'd been a massive decline in the number of publicly listed companies in the United States, operating companies. I'm not talking about funds, but we had gone from 9,000 publicly listed companies on NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange down to 5,000, and nobody knew it. And we demonstrated this. We also demonstrated that we were performing the worst in terms of this decline of any of the countries we could get data. China was performing the best. So that we were the ones that actually motivated Congress and demonstrated. Actually, I think they were frankly terrified the way we were terrified to discover this. And so we got everybody moving to come up with solutions. And, the Jobs Act, people don't realize, but it was actually a roll up an omnibus bill of six separate bills that created everything from Reg CF crowdfunding, generally solicited private placements, Regulation A+, the emerging growth company designation, testing the waters. It created this whole category of crossover buyers pre-IPO, on which there have been thousands, and everybody's gotten into the game. Why is that important? I mean, all the major institutions, from T. Rowe Price to Fidelity to in the life sciences sector, OrbiMed, Deerfield, Perceptives, and that helped credentialize companies pre-IPO, which gave a lot of other institutions the confidence to go in and buy these IPOs, which is, you know, which helped support the IPO market quite a bit.
What was the support in Congress for the Jobs Act?
That was incredibly bipartisan. I mean, it actually gave me, gives me great hope for this country, because you know, you're not used to seeing that. And these votes have been disproportionately for this kind of legislation. There was another, massive piece of legislation that we had some doing on that didn't make it through because it got caught up when Trump shut down the wall in the 2018 Congress. So it was kind of collateral damage, but it went through the House 406-4. That one. I mean, you can't even get a proclamation in support of motherhood and apple pie through the U.S. Congress, 406-4. And that included a new form of stock exchange to support smaller IPOs in the aftermarket, which we worked on with Congressman Emmer's office in Minnesota. So we'll probably hopefully come back and get something like that done, because I think it's important to the research and development part of the U.S. economy. And I think most, you know, most congressmen, if you can spend enough time educating them, you know, seem to get that pretty quickly. And so I'm optimistic. We just, and one of the things, Wheel & Co. is actually in the middle of a capital raise right now. But when we get that done, I mean, we've been approached to set up a 501c3 foundation that might be tax deductible to do the educational kind of work and create solutions, if you will, for things, everything from capital markets to how do we deal with Social Security to the deficit. So we're, you know, we think we learned quite a bit about how to break down problems and propose solutions that are politically viable, that both parties can embrace, that can move the country forward. And I think what we learned and what I learned from this journey, and by the way, my role was I was the subject matter expert. I think, you know, John, I was vice chairman of NASDAQ and I ran the listings business at NASDAQ many years ago. I was also the head of equity capital markets at a top 10 firm, priced 500 public equity IPOs, 500 follow-on equity offerings, pioneered the use of Form S3 shelf registrations in the 90s. And so I've grown up in markets. And I think that what, you know, we in on Wall Street take for granted is not obvious to sometimes even the SEC, because it's mostly the commissioners are mostly lawyers and not practitioners. And so I think what I've taken away is that rather than trading for your, you know, own book and arguing for your own self-interest, there's a real need in Washington for people that can be truth tellers and problem solvers and can break things down and make them very easily understood by people who, like, you know, unlike you and me, did not grow up in markets, in capital markets.
What is it that is really working within the Jobs Act? What are the parts that are really working?
Well, I think first I would say that a common refrain from almost every head of the Division of Corporation Finance at the SEC that I've ever encountered is that they pass rules and then they're shocked at how long it takes the market to adopt those rule changes or to make use of them or to figure out how to make use of them. And that was the case back in the 1990s when they passed the shelf registration rules, right? I mean, nobody did anything. And I actually walked in to see Linda Quinn, who had been the head of the Division of Corporation Finance at the SEC, and said, you know, I want to, you know, people are, companies are going out and doing equity offerings and their stocks are getting hit by hedge funds, which at the time was an emerging class. It was relatively new. And so their cost of capital is going way up as their stock price goes down. We have an idea to file a kitchen sink shelf registration and do an overnight equity offering and not announce it after the close so that you don't take that market risk so that we can get issuers a better outcome. And she looked at me and she started laughing. I said, why are you laughing? And she said, because that's exactly why we passed the rule. And we can't understand why nobody has done that yet. So I said, you know, I think I know the answer. I think it's because you got to evergreen due diligence. You have to keep your due diligence files up to date because you can't just pop an offering without having done due diligence. And so we did that. We had sort of a state of readiness. We put people on pagers and then we announced a deal for a company called Mailwell at 4:01 in the afternoon after the market closed. But prior to that, we'd been telling everybody in the institutional sales force that we had a deal that we were going to announce at the close. So everybody, man your battle stations, stay put. We pulled the analyst over the wall. And at 4:01 p.m., we announced that we were doing an equity offering. It was going to be an overnight equity deal off the shelf, kitchen sink shelf registration. And we popped an overnight equity offering. And it ended up, I think we priced $125 million on a sole managed basis and put the print out at night. And I remember getting the call from Goldman Sachs' equity syndicate head, David Miller, saying, Wield, what the F was that you just, you know, did? And that was the beginning of all of this innovation that went around, you know, more rapid equity offerings that were designed to minimize the impact on share price by hanging out there and letting people short ahead of the deal. Like, for example, I mean, you know, registered directs, at the market offerings, accelerated book builds, overnight equity offerings. This now accounts for 60% of all public equity issuance in U.S. markets.
So what is not working within the Jobs Act?
Well, I mean, I would say that the Jobs Act works, but, you know, that it there were things that are working, knocking in the markets in general. And that stuff still needs to be solved for. And that's the aftermarket support model and the distribution model. I mean, we've converted most retail brokers into wealth advisors who are getting a percentage of assets under management. So instead of being, stock brokers and storytellers that provided aftermarket support and research. So we need an economic model that will pay and a change in thinking that will bring back all of that support, aftermarket support that's required. Now, in the meantime, there are all sorts of innovators that are very gradually working on using, you know, electronic marketing and newsletter and other techniques to bring in investors as a alternative form of direct to investor distribution, and with varying results. And so, you know, we created a construct. People are working with that construct. There's a learning curve. They're getting better at doing it, and better at working through the aftermarket support consequences of, for instance, direct marketing. But at the end of the day, we still need an economic model that's not paid for by companies, that's paid for by the market, which was the old, you know, quarter point spread, higher commission model, to kind of give people an incentive to go back out and tell stories. And so that's what's missing. And there's a reason structurally for that, John, which is that smaller capitalization stocks are asymmetrical order book stocks. That's the academic term, which means that when there's a big seller, there's typically no buyer. Somebody has, as an intermediary, has to go out to create that buyer or buyers, plural, to offset the seller, to create, you know, spot instantaneous liquidity. Otherwise, the stock price goes down. And the flip side is that when you got a big buyer, you need somebody to go into the market to find sellers to sell into that buyer. And that, again, that's the job of an intermediator. But what they did with modern day electronic markets that have penny increments for trading is they took out all the economics for all of the service providers, the intermediaries. And so micro cap markets and small cap markets, you know, less, but micro cap markets most really break down. So you've seen institutional, fundamentally oriented institutional investors that used to be very active in, say, $250 million market value companies, $150 million market value companies like the Fidelities and the T. Rowe. T. Rowe's of the world. They have largely vacated the micro cap markets. And because of this, the loss of liquidity, which had been provided by intermediaries. And so you now have a market in the micro cap area that's largely, you know, dominated by retail investors, and they're self-directed investors. And it becomes a very, from an issuer's perspective, from the company's perspective, it's almost vexing to try and navigate. Doesn't work very well.
Yeah.
So that we need a new aftermarket, to answer your question, aftermarket market support model. We probably need a new stock exchange, which is what we worked on with Congressman Emmer's model. Right now, we have a one-size-fits-all stock market structure. It works great for large cap stocks. It's a disaster for small cap stocks. If you can lower the barrier, just to answer your question, to going public, because you can bring back more distribution, you'll do more IPOs that are earlier stage, which means you'll also attract lots more money into private markets, which will in turn drive a tidal wave of entrepreneurship and innovation for this country. And those are things that I think you sorely need to maintain U.S. competitiveness, national security, to have a higher likelihood of finding more cures for cancer or Alzheimer's or whatever name the disease, and to ultimately maintain U.S. leadership in areas like semiconductors, which are critical to national defense. We need an aftermarket support model for stocks that are not naturally liquid, right? Which is the entire micro cap, small cap universe. Why is that important? That's the feeder system to the big leagues. That's the innovation economy, okay? These are the things that actually solve, you know, all companies start small, John. They all start small. And, you know, and if you lose your incubator system, your innovation system, you're basically lost. You can't compete against China. You can't compete against the rest of the world. And ultimately, the United States has to punch above its weight, right? We only have 330 million people in this country. Countries like China have 1.3 billion, okay? So that means that we have to get all hands on deck. We have to enable entrepreneurs. And right now, we've got an innovation economy that's largely concentrated in major venture capital states. It only does a small cross section of things that are viable for this public equity market. And I would say that it underinvests in things like semiconductors. That's why we had a semiconductor bill. But we should have markets, you know, taking care of that. Manufacturing, we need all these things. We need manufacturing because we need that infrastructure in this country to be able to sustain the, you know, the production of materiel in the case of a war. And, you know, you look at right now, I mean, we're probably not producing enough shells to support Ukraine, which is why we're going ahead with cluster bombs at this point in time. So all this stuff is interrelated. And this is a critical part of the U.S. competitive infrastructure right now. It's not performing the way it needs to perform for the benefit of breakthroughs in life sciences, breakthroughs in medical devices, breakthroughs in national security and defense. And so that's why I think that I'm highly confident if we can get those messages out to Washington, that we'll ultimately be successful in creating a new form of stock market to do a better job of supporting smaller capitalization, innately illiquid stocks. And that in turn will bring a lot of capital into the private market. So as I like to say, it's a game of incrementalism. You know, we have to continue to be good stewards of our markets. You know, the challenge is that regulators, SEC is a political institution, right? They get their budget allocation from Congress. And so if they misstep, they tend to be a little bit gun shy. And if they misstep in doing something, Congress will threaten to cut their budget. So it ends up on the backs of people like me as a good American and a good citizen to take that expertise and to share it with people on the Hill to soften up the beachhead so that doing these kinds of things that will require more brokers and more commission compensation and more intermediaries actually is seen ultimately as a good thing for America in general and not just simply a way to compensate Wall Street, which would not be very popular. But you know, as sure as I'm sitting here, it's an essential requirement for the long-term competitiveness of the United States. And it's one of those things that must be done, will be done at some point in time, because rational people will see their way to that conclusion if they are properly educated. And so we have to go out and do the education.
So let me ask you this, David. What did the Jobs Act cost? What was the impact of the Jobs Act to the budget?
Jobs Act actually is adding money to the U.S. Treasury. It cost the U.S. government $0. It cost them a little bit of time over the SEC to write the rules because the Jobs Act, most of the titles of the Jobs Act were remanded to the SEC for rulemaking, but that was already in their budget. So there was no incremental apportionment of budget. There was no budget for the Jobs Act. It just was, you know, it's a better way of enabling the market, you know, to go out and make the investments to then drive entrepreneurship, which then drives capital gains, which when people sell, creates tax revenue for the U.S. economy. That's the elegance of it, right? Which is to say that we didn't ask Congress for a check. We're giving U.S. Treasury through this act, ultimately incremental revenue and incremental jobs, and they're high quality jobs.
So as you had the big institutions kind of vacate the micro cap space and all, and you always kind of had the pink sheet markets and all that kind of thing at the very bottom of the marketplace. What has the impact of the Jobs Act been on that marketplace?
Well, I mean, what we did was we created a really interesting toolkit that creates a lot of optionality for people to, you know, raise money. And look, and already, you know, public company can do a Regulation A-plus filing. They can do a private placement. They can do a generally solicited private placement now that they couldn't do prior to the Jobs Act. So, you know, as I like to say, it's really augmenting the toolkit for entrepreneurs, securities lawyers. And, you know, as I've always been taught in markets, options have value. So we created a lot of optionality for a lot of people. And there's a lot of minds that are dedicated to figuring out how to make it work with alternative forms of distribution. I was just with a group that actually is doing direct marketing through newsletters, and then looking at people who are subscribers and trying to match companies and ideas that would resonate with those subscribers of those newsletters and get companies funded. And in some instances, in private markets now, they're taking equity, you know, positions, and it's all disclosed as part of as their compensation, effectively, to go out, you know, help the companies raise capital through 506C or Reg CF, as the case might be.
Do you have a favorite Reg CF story in terms of a company that used the regulation to get started?
Well, I think one of the first, you know, crowd-funded companies that then went public, and it's, you know, it's sometimes they work and sometimes they don't, but it was sort of a proof point, was a company that was, funded by an Israeli crowdfunding site that was doing exoskeletons for those that are paralyzed, ReWalk, that then went public in the United States. And it was the first, I think, crowdfunded IPO. I think that, you know, just the fact that it's in an industry where it's helping people get up and stand upright is kind of magical. I mean, it's a great metaphor for funding ingenuity and engineering and problem solving to improve mankind. But I will tell you though that I just got goosebumps when I heard Lawrence Kim, who was the co-chair of the life sciences practice at Goldman Sachs. Okay, and I was at a 10-year sort of victory lap hosted by Cowen and Company in Washington, D.C. Spencer Baucus was there. He was the former chairman of the House Financial Services Committee and a Republican. And then Tim Johnson, who was the Democratic head of the Senate Banking Committee. And they were kind of celebrating the 10th anniversary of the Jobs Act, which is interesting because most of it, you know, most of the rules were not released by the SEC until 5 years into it. So at that time, it was only 5 years old. It's now maybe 6 years old in terms of its benefits. And Lawrence publicly said that the Jobs Act funded the messenger RNA vaccine technology of Moderna. And according to The Economist a year ago in an article, it saved over 2 million lives. That's what it was estimated. Now, if that's all that the Jobs Act did, and it did a lot more than that, it would be worth it. Because as we all know, that those are disproportionately Americans. We saved just right there 2 million lives. Wow. That's why we did the act, because we believe that innovation is done by small companies. Let me back up and explain to your listeners why it's not done really by large companies. Large companies are concerned about earnings per share in public markets. And they have to every quarter, you know, do better. And as a consequence, if you spend lots of money on research and development, a couple of things happen. One is you're risk averse. You're worried about scandal and taking risks and things like that. That doesn't work well in a large company because you can drive down your stock price pretty quickly. The risk takers, if you will, in the smaller companies. But the other thing is that research and development drags on earnings. Okay. And also companies that really it doesn't move their earnings per share needle until the company gets all the way up through phase three clinical trials and gets close to an approval. So the research and development part of our economy is really largely the innovation part of our economy is the small companies. So if we don't have a vibrant system to get more of these companies funded, it stands to reason that we're going to have significantly less research and development and significantly fewer breakthroughs and significantly less forward progress in terms of the quality of our lives and our national security. So it's kind of non-negotiable. I mean, the fact that we are where we are is because I think a lot of policymakers don't understand the difference between large cap stock markets that are symmetrical order book with tens of thousands of buyers and sellers interacting in an order book and micro cap order books. They just look at the stock market as being sort of monolithic. The market is the market. Well, no, the market's not the market. The market is how we design it in terms of the rules and the incentives and the disincentives. And so, you know, we have to have more nuanced, more informed market design. And we can't, since the companies don't trade the same, we can never have a one size fits all stock market. And that's what we have right now in terms of how the aftermarket trades. So we have to get to a marketplace where there are two market structures, one which supports the innovation economy and storytelling stocks, and one which supports trading in innately liquid stocks where you don't need the intermediaries as much and where people can afford to save money on transaction costs, where that's ultimately, you know, in the best interest of pension funds and everyone else. So that is a key goal of ours. And, you know, if we do that, I would tell you that the Jobs Act will look like a down payment on our future, and our future will be fulfilled by that market.
I'm sorry. I think that's a great spot to end. Or do you have any final thoughts you want to give?
Oh, I mean, look, I'm an inclusionist. Okay, I'm a believer that we have to get all of America to work together, that our secret sauce is our diversity. And in fact, it shows up in the academic literature that diverse organizations, diverse people outperform monolithic people. Why? Because we come at problems with a variety of perspectives and we see things that, in fact, there's a form of artificial intelligence called collective intelligence that will tell you that if you have a number of professionals with different expertise looking at the same problem, that they'll outperform a vertical market expert in a venture capital fund, which is the kind of the traditional venture model. And so I think that, you know, rather than resist diversity, we should, you know, double up on it, figure out how to do it better. I would tell you that, you know, we've been debating about our southern border on immigration, but there hasn't been a lot of discussion. Why aren't we out there recruiting the best scientists and engineers from the rest of the world and rolling out the red carpet and, you know, making the United States a great place for them to come? Because they get historically some of the greatest, you know, breakthroughs in Silicon Valley. They've come from first generation immigrants, you know, so. That's an area of our economy that I think we need to understand. It's not a threat to us. It's a potential competitive advantage as well.
You mentioned that you thought that the Jobs Act was perhaps kind of the unknown, understated economic engine that was helping drive the jobs creation here in the economy. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think that when people lose jobs or they have to figure out what to do, they one of the things that was missing was the ability for the average individual to go out and be unshackled and try and raise bits of capital. And so it's created a whole kind of system. There's now 80 or so portals that are reporting into FINRA, overseen by FINRA, in various permutations of crowdfunding. And so we've got an ability to access capital now to start new businesses that wasn't there before. And I think people are doing it. I don't think it's probably very well tracked. We decriminalize. I mean, just the fact that you tell people that you can do this and you're not going to be incarcerated for it like you were prior to the Jobs Act, causes people to go out and take initiative. And initiative is absolutely, critical. So I think one of the things that the economists have been struggling with for some time now is why have the jobs numbers in the face of higher interest rates continued to be pretty good and better than they have expected. And I think that it may have something to do that with the fact that we've got more tools in the toolkit for the reinvention of the economy, so that as people get sloughed off, more businesses are likely to be capitalized and employ more people and be able to retain more people. And so there may be a little bit of new performance in the entrepreneurial side of the economy that didn't exist prior to the Jobs Act. I'm not sure how you quantify it, John. I'm just saying that, that if you look at it historically, small companies are the ones that employ people. And it's not the big ones. The big ones are rationalizing their businesses and have had a tendency to cut employment over markets cycles. And so real job growth, and the Kaufman Institute will tell you this, is always from the bedrock of job growth and job creation is the entrepreneurial part of the economy. And what we did was we gave an infusion of fuel to that part of the economy.